Great to have you with us on WPR News. Today, we begin the show by turning our attention to your eyes' health. And it's great to have Dr. Matthew Cook with us from the Mayo Clinic in Eau Claire. He's an ophthalmologist, vice chair of Mayo Clinic Health System Ophthalmology. And we'll talk with Dr. Cook about taking care of your eyes this summer. And, of course, we'll take your questions about eyesight and eye health as well as we move along today. And, of course, love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Matthew Cook, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
I'm wondering, someone mentioned asked if you were an optometrist, and I said no, an ophthalmologist. Is there a difference? What's the difference between an ophthalmologist and optometrist?
Good question. They're both eye doctors, so both ophthalmologists and optometrists spend our days seeing and treating patients, you know, with eye conditions and for eye health. Optometrists have different training than ophthalmologists. Optometrists, after completing college, would complete 4 years of optometry school, and some then do an additional year of what's called residency training. And their practice tends to be more focused on, I would say, medical issues with the eye, such as glasses, contact lenses, or treating diseases with, you know, medications in some cases. Ophthalmologists go to medical school for 4 years after college and then do 4 years of residency and in some cases do additional training. For instance, I did one extra year of what we call fellowship training. My training was in treating glaucoma. So ophthalmologists do surgery in addition to, prescribing glasses and seeing patients in clinic. So I would say the training is different, and the fact that ophthalmologists do surgery are the main differences.
Let's turn our attention to summertime and those bright skies. A lot of sunshine out there. Why would it be a good idea, or why is it a good idea to wear sunglasses in order to protect your eyes?
Yeah, so besides the obvious comfort that wearing sunglasses can give by reducing, you know, bright glare and sunlight, they also protect the eyes from many diseases. For example, cataracts are a common disease, but they can get worse quicker from UV light, which is in sunlight. And there are other things as well, macular degeneration, which is another common disease that people can get as they get older. A risk factor for that is thought to be UV light, so wearing sunglasses reduces the risk of that. It can also reduce the risk of cancer to the eyelids or to the eye itself. And it might decrease the risk of glaucoma, limiting UV light. So I think there are a lot of good reasons to wear sunglasses besides just making the eyes more comfortable.
Yeah. I'm wondering about those of us who have glasses and wear glasses. Of course, you can get clips can protect. But I'm wondering about those glasses that are called adjustable, and so they get a little darker when it's brighter out. Are these perhaps as good as if you had a good pair of UV sunglasses?
Yeah, I would say the main factor is whether the lenses block UV light. So you're talking, I think, about transition lenses where the lens itself darkens in many people's prescription glasses when they're in sunlight. And typically, prescription glasses do have UV protection. So even if they're not tinted, usually they would also protect from UV light like sunglasses would. If they're not tinted, of course, the eyes, they're not going to reduce brightness the way that sunglasses would. So I would say the best way is to ask when you're buying glasses or if you've already bought them, you know, check with the place you bought them to make sure. But I would expect that typically glasses would block UV light as well, even if they're not sunglasses.
Lee in Delafield has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Lee.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I have have had transition lenses for about the past 10 years with just a astigmatism correction for distance and a reading correction. In the last three prescriptions I've gotten transition lenses, I've had so much trouble in trying to adjust to them, and finally found out that now they are in the transitions putting a mid-level distance in the middle of the lens, and now I've had to go back to the ugly, you know, bifocal lens, which I hate. Is there any recourse for someone like me? And I'm not the only one. I've talked to a lot of friends who have had this issue with that mid-range.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think what I would say is, to me, that it doesn't sound like the issue is specific to transition lenses that you're having. So transition lenses can be put in glasses with no bifocal or with a lined bifocal or a no-line bifocal. If you have glasses with a no-line bifocal, the way they're designed, they do have, as you look further down in the lens, it gradually gives you more focus so that in the bottom you can see for reading, but then in the middle of the lens you can see for intermediate. So that's what it sounds like you're describing to me. I don't know why it worked better for you in the past and hasn't the last few years, but to me that problem sounds more like a bifocal issue. Unfortunately, to get a no line, to the best of my knowledge, that's the way bifocals are made, is they're made to be progressive, we call it, or where they gradually increase in focus. If you want something that's just for near, I think a traditional bifocal is unfortunately the way you have to go to do that.
Yeah. I have a pair of glasses, because I have to do a lot of reading for my job. I have a pair of glasses that are just for close, and then I have the regular pair that I wear all day long, but then when I'm going to read for an hour or so, I have that other pair of glasses that are just for close.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really nice.
Yeah, and certainly that would be another option for that caller or someone. If they don't need the glasses to have distance and near, you could do distance only and get them transition. Or you could even do reading only. You probably wouldn't want to do that with transition lenses, but that is an option too, is separate glasses for different distances.
Lee, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Someone wonders about getting a speck of sand or dirt in your eye. If you get a small speck of sand, which I've gotten many occasions, I think the last time was in the golf course when I was hitting out of a sand trap. I had a bit of trouble getting it out, washing it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can be. I think washing it out is what I would suggest trying to do. If you could use teardrops, if a lot of people carry around teardrops with them, like lubricant eye drops, you could try several drops of that. The eye tends to water when something gets in it.
Yeah.
So often the eye will do the job itself, and just the watering and the tearing will rinse out what's there. But I think if it continues to be an issue, there are over-the-counter eye washes. You could try, you know, a little more thoroughly rinsing it. And if all else fails, contact an eye doctor if need be.
Great way to spend a hot day, of course, is to visit a pool or a lake. What about a lake or pool water interacting with your eyes? Is it ever a good idea to swim with your eyes open?
Yeah, my recommendation, well, first of all, one thing I'll say about swimming is don't do it with contact lenses in, because there can be dangerous infections that can occur if your eye were to get water in it while wearing a contact lens, especially swimming underwater. So that would be my first tip that I think is the most important, is don't swim with contact lenses in. They can make prescription, you know, goggles, like swim goggles. So if someone's a serious swimmer and needs contacts to be able to see, that would be an option, but definitely should not swim with contact lenses in. I think, you know, a little bit of water getting in the eye for someone who in most cases doesn't have contacts. Probably not overly harmful, but I think the safest thing is to wear goggles, particularly with swimming underwater. It just reduces the risk of whatever bacteria or, you know, chemicals might be in the pool or the lake. So I think the safest thing is to swim with goggles.
Yeah. We've been mentioning contact lenses, and Leo in La Crosse has a question, I believe, relating to contact lenses. Let's go there. Hi, Leo.
Hey, so I've been wearing contacts for like, you know, 10-ish years now, and my first eye doctor said it's really important to buy name brand contact solution. But, you know, as a broke college kid, the generic brand is always so tempting to buy. So is it important to buy name brand, or what's kind of your opinion on that?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think this might be one of those things where if you ask 10 eye doctors, they probably might not all agree on the answer. In general, just my personal rule of thumb is I'm more of a generic guy. You know, if I can choose between a brand name product and a generic that's a lot cheaper, I'll often pick the generic because I figure it's about the same. Or if I'm choosing between generic acetaminophen or brand name Tylenol, I'll probably pick the generic. The concern that I do have with eye products, in the last couple of years, there were quite a few over-the-counter generic lubricant drops, like artificial tear drops, that actually were contaminated and had to be taken off the market. And so since that happened, I'm a little more leery of generics, and I think brand name is probably a little better. But cost concerns are real, and I think I suspect the risk of using a generic is not very high, but perhaps brand name is a little safer.
All right. Leo, there you go. Thank you so much for joining. Talking today with Dr. Matthew Cook, ophthalmologist for Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire. Questions for him, you can give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at your eyes' health today with Dr. Matthew Cook, ophthalmologist for Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire. Great to have him with us. And certainly join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Let's talk about cataracts for a minute or two, Dr. Cook. What are cataracts and how do they form?
Yeah, cataract is a common condition that people, especially as they get older, get. It's where the lens of the eye gets cloudy. So we're born with a lens. It helps to focus light into the back of our eye, like the lens of a camera. And as we age, occasionally people can be born with cataracts, but usually it's an aging disease where over time the lens can get more and more cloudy. And eventually that can lead to reduced vision. It can lead to glare. More, you know, people often can have trouble reading or seeing detail like road signs or things on the TV. And eventually, it can even lead to blindness if cataracts are untreated and get bad enough.
So, and so it's mostly an age thing in terms of the cause?
Yeah, that's the main risk factor is aging. As the eye ages, and specifically as the lens changes, there are changes on the molecule, individual molecule level, that changes in the water composition of the lens that cause it to get less clear, more cloudy. So aging is the main thing. There are other things that can happen to someone or someone can be exposed to, like radiation, for instance, or steroid medicines, or an injury to the eye. Things like that can cause them to form sooner or other medications. But the biggest risk factor, and smoking or being exposed to cigarette smoking is another risk factor for getting them earlier. But the biggest risk factor is getting older.
I had some cataract surgery on one of my eyes that turned out fine. I'm wondering, when's it time to consider the surgery, and how safe do you feel? Or how, you know, what are the numbers show us in terms of safety of it?
Yeah, so in most cases, cataract surgery is elective, meaning when to do it is primarily when it's affecting someone's, you know, activities that they need to do or that they enjoy doing. So if someone's working as an airline pilot, they might need surgery sooner than someone who is retired and no longer drives. So the biggest factor is when is it affecting someone's quality of life or their, you know, I would say their activities that they need to do to live and enjoy life. As far as the risk of surgery, every surgery has risks. So it would be wrong to say it's zero risk, but I would describe cataract surgery as low risk. I would say 98 plus, you know, 98 to 99 out of 100 times it goes well. There is a small risk, roughly 1 in 1,000, of something devastating happening like losing vision. So that's why we don't jump into it if we don't need to. But for people who need surgery, it's low risk and usually very successful.
Are there alternatives to the surgery?
There are not currently any alternatives to fixing cataracts apart from surgery. There are researchers are looking at whether medications could prevent cataracts from growing. And of course, there are things to try to prevent them or slow them, like we talked about with wearing sunglasses or UV protection outside, like avoiding smoking. Mm-hmm. But generally, you can't avoid getting older, and with that being the biggest risk factor, no way to prevent them.
Okay. Yeah, well, certainly don't want to avoid getting older.
Right.
That's for sure. Maria in Stratford has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Maria.
Hello there, and thanks for addressing the cataracts. I get to deal with that. It sounds like up and coming before I know it, but I am a lupus patient, and I take hydroxychloroquine, and I'm wondering, I have to see an ophthalmologist every year, and so far so good as far as any eye damage, but I am almost 60 years old. I've been taking it since I was diagnosed in 19. So I'm wondering, is there something? I know my ophthalmologist would like to see the dosage lessened. I'm at 200 milligrams now. He'd like to see 150. Should I be looking? My lupus specialist doesn't want to lower the dose. I mean, is there something, you know, what do you see? What's your experience in dealing with Plaquenil or hydroxychloroquine?
Yeah, good question. Hydroxychloroquine can rarely cause damage to the retina of the eye. The retina is in the back of the eye where light focuses, and they can lead to something called retinopathy or damage to the retina. And the risk of that is higher at higher doses, and it's higher the longer someone takes it. So I would be more worried about someone who had taken hydroxychloroquine for 30 years, let's say, than I would be for someone who had taken it for 1 year. We do recommend annual screening to assess for retinopathy or retinal problems. And so it sounds like you're on top of that, you and your ophthalmologist. As far as the dosing from an eye, you know, from our standpoint, we, of course, would say less is better. But from a rheumatologist's or a lupus specialist's point of view, they may feel that a higher dose is needed to control the disease that's being treated. So I think these are really decisions that have to be made between you and your doctors and to try to decide what's the safest dose that will hopefully work, but that will be enough to work. And everything has risks. Every medicine has risks. Everything in life has risks. So, you know, your doctors are recommending you take that risk because they think it'll help your lupus. And so I think that's the way I would look at it. And if there is a problem with your eyes detected, I imagine your eye doctor would, I'm sure, let you know and likely change your medicine.
Yeah. Maria, thank you for calling. Jay in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Jay.
Yes, good morning. After decades of using contact lenses, I've used a number of different brands of multi-purpose solution, all with good results, never had any trouble. But in the last year and a half, I switched to a hydrogen peroxide cleaning system. It's a little more convenient because there's no rubbing or rinsing necessary. And, of course, there's no additional chemical chemicals in it other than the hydrogen peroxide. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other. In full disclosure, an optometrist would probably be better able to answer that. I don't prescribe contact lenses routinely in my practice. So from my perspective, I think, you know, either cleaning method is okay, and the most important thing is to clean them when needed and not to wear them for long periods, like sleeping in them or wearing them for long periods, because that would increase the risk of an infection. But I think either one should work, and from my perspective, at least, I wouldn't have a concern with you using the hydrogen peroxide solution.
No. There you go, Jay. Thank you. Barbara in Neillsville, your turn. Hi, Barbara.
Yeah, hi. I am having a rhinoplasty done in September, actually at Rochester Mayo, which I love over there, and because I have a deviated septum. And I have not had an eye exam for a couple years, and I need one. So should I wait until after my surgery is over with in September to have my eye exam?
I would not think that it would matter, really. You know, you're probably not going to want to have it done immediately after the procedure, because you'll likely not be feeling well and need some time to recover. In general, you know, how often someone needs an eye exam depends on their age and whether they have eye issues or certain medical issues, but usually they're not urgent, and so it might be difficult for you to get in between now and September, and if so, and if you need to wait until afterward, without knowing your whole medical situation, I would assume that it would be okay to wait.
Okay. Barbara, there you go. Thank you for calling. And Terry in Madison, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate the show.
Thank you.
I've been told that I have cataracts. I know I do. I'm 80, and I know lots of people in their 60s and 70s who have had the surgery. I keep being told that I can't have cataract surgery until my eyes, until the vision can no longer be corrected to 20/20. And this is really frustrating. I have friends who go in and get the surgery and come back with perfect eyes. And frankly, I'd like to have my vision be better. So why do they keep saying this?
Well, I think my answer to that would be, going back to what I said earlier about cataract surgery, it does have risks, and they're low, but they're not zero. And so when, you know, of course, I haven't seen you, I don't know how bad your cataracts are, et cetera. But generally, when someone sees well, I often do recommend waiting on surgery, because, you know, there's always the possibility it could make you worse. And so we're trying to think about what are the risks. Well, they're low, but perhaps if you're already 20/20, maybe the benefit might be low too. So I presume that's probably why your doctors told you that. Certainly you could always, of course, get a second opinion, see someone else and you know, just to see what they think. One thing that cataracts often do is they can cause glare. So they can cause trouble with night driving, like from headlights. So sometimes there might be someone who's 20/20, but if you expose them to glare, their vision can really drop and they might feel unsafe driving at night. So we'll often in the clinic do glare testing to try to simulate that and see if maybe someone might seem to have good vision, but in their everyday life, they may really be struggling from the cataract.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a good point. I'm wondering, would insurance have anything to do with it? That's, you know, if a person was coming in at 20/20, the insurance might say, well, no, we're not going to pay for cataracts if your vision is okay.
Correct. That would be another reason as well why typically as doctors, we don't want to have a patient's, you know, insurance not cover something. Someone could come in at age 30 with no cataract, and we could do the same surgery if they were, let's say, really nearsighted, and we were trying to put a lens implant in their eye so that they no longer need contacts or glasses. But that's something the patient would have to pay for. So you're correct. That payers or, you know, insurers have a say here too, and often there are criteria they use to define when they'll pay for surgery, meaning vision criteria, that it has to be bad enough.
Yeah, I wondered about that. That might be something else you could ask about, Terry, too, when you next time you talk to your insurance provider or your doctor. Wayne in Hayward, your turn. Hi, Wayne.
Yeah, well, thank you for taking my call. I have what they call macular edema, and my ophthalmologist has injected my eye many times, and nothing seems to work to help the edema. I just was wondering if there's another procedure that the doctor would recommend.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think it's one that's a little hard to answer without having examined you and knowing all the details. Part of, you know, macular edema means swelling of the macula. So the macula is part of the retina, and it's the center part where light focuses. So if someone has swelling of that, it can affect their vision. The reason it's hard to answer the question is that's somewhat of a generic term, kind of like you might say, I have swelling of my hand. Well, how do you treat it? Well, it depends. Is your hand swollen because you had an injury, or is it because you have rheumatoid arthritis, or is it because there's a rash? So it's a general term, and often injections are used, but it depends why you have the swelling of your macula. Sometimes eye drops can help. Sometimes surgery can help. But it's hard for me to give a real specific answer without knowing all the details. And I would imagine that your eye doctor has already considered what other options there are, but be a good question to ask them.
All right, Wayne, thank you for calling. And Mary in Wauwatosa, we move to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have had corneal erosion on a chronic basis for a long time. And I'm wondering what I should be doing and what other possibilities might exist in terms of doing something to the cornea that this doesn't keep happening. It's very painful.
And maybe you could start, Dr. Cook, by talking about what is a corneal erosion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, corneal erosion is a condition. Typically what happens is someone wakes up with a painful eye, and we think what happens is the cornea, that's the front part of the eye, so that's the window into the eye, it's the part of the eye that would have LASIK, for instance, if someone has LASIK or PRK, but that cornea sticks to the eyelid, and then when the eyelid's open, it can tear it apart and cause a scratch or an abrasion of the cornea. And abrasions heal. They can be very painful, though, and make the vision blurry while they're there. Some people get recurrent, or in other words, they get repeated erosions. And there are certain eye conditions that can cause that, or sometimes having an injury to the eye could cause an erosion. So it'd be interesting to know if this was in one eye or both eyes. If it's always the same eye, I would wonder if perhaps there was an injury that started it. But in any case, there are things that can be done, especially if people are having them repeatedly. Certain medications, so hypertonic sodium chloride, like salt water, a brand is Muro, M-U-R-O 128, Muro 128, it comes in a drop and an ointment form. That can reduce the risk of it. Another option are there are procedures that can be done, either where an ophthalmologist would either make small little pokes basically in the eye to try to get it to stick together so it doesn't come apart when the eyelids rub on it, or there can be a laser procedure that is similarly tries to improve healing. So I think for you, if you're having these repeated issues, I think that would be worth talking to your eye doctor about would a procedure help you, particularly if you've already been trying the hypertonic saline medications.
Yeah. Would there be maybe an issue or an opportunity for a cornea transplant in something like this?
We do we as an ophthalmologist do corneal transplants. I would say that would not be a typical reason for one of the erosion, just simply because there's a better way to treat it that's less invasive, which would be, like I said, either a different type of laser or the punctures. But there are there are situations where we do transplant the cornea, and it's a very successful procedure. So for people with certain eye problems where the cornea is swollen, the transplant is the best treatment for them.
Yeah, I had a cornea transplant myself. let's see, probably 8 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, I was very fortunate to have it. And really appreciate the person who passed away and whose cornea I was able to obtain. It was life-changing for me, for sure. Mary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to another caller, Sharon in Dubuque, Iowa. We'll go to you. Hi, Sharon.
Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead, Sharon.
Oh, sorry. Okay, so I have a clear kind of, or I guess it's like a Vaseline-type floater in my eye, and it doesn't seem to be going away, which they said it might. They did say there's a surgery for it, but I have amblyopia, so I'm afraid to have surgery on my good eye.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so again, I'm speaking a little bit speculatively because I haven't seen you, and but from what you're describing, my guess would be that you're describing a vitreous detachment, which is where it's an aging change where the gel that fills the back of the eye, that gel is called vitreous, it comes apart or it detaches, it separates from the back of the eye, and then it can cause a floater that often is Vaseline-like or clear, you know, where you can see through it, but it's not completely transparent and it can be very annoying. And many people get used to them. So I tell my patients the same thing it sounds like your eye doctor did, which is try to get used to it, try to ignore it. And most people, they do tell me either that they go away or they get used to them and they can tolerate them. There is a surgery. The surgery would, the most common, at least, surgery to treat it would be to remove the gel or to do a surgery called a vitrectomy, to remove the vitreous gel. And that is successful and it's low risk, but this is like any surgery, whether a corneal transplant or cataract surgery, or in this case, removing the gel, there is some risk. And if someone has amblyopia, or in other words, a lazy eye, so that their other eye doesn't see well, you do want to proceed with caution, you know, when thinking about surgery in the good eye. And should you do it? That's a personal question, because it depends how bothered you are by it and how willing you are to tolerate those risks.
Yeah. Sharon, things to think about. Thank you so much for calling. Lance, who's in Guadalajara, Mexico. Thank you for calling, Lance. What's on your mind?
Hello. Just recently, I've had a situation where a blurry spot develops in just my left eye, makes it difficult to read. And the first time it occurred, it seemed to be accompanied with sort of a sparkly aspect to it, almost as if I'd been staring at a light bulb, and I had that after image of a light bulb occluding some of my vision. Did you? Any advice about this?
So this is, did it occur for a relatively short period of time and then go away?
About 5 or 8 minutes.
Okay. But then it's come back again since?
Well, I just had the second episode of it just this morning, so I thought it was very timely that you're on the show.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the first advice I would give is, I think it would be good to have an eye exam to try to arrange that. I will tell you, just from hearing your story, my guess would be you might be having a migraine. Did you get a headache after either episode?
No, quite relaxed in the head. It sort of almost felt like that eye was very relaxed, if that's any kind of description, but it didn't seem, I just quit reading for a while and lay down with my eyes closed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it might be a migraine. If that's the case, there's not really, Often we don't treat them if the only symptom is some a change in the vision, although there are medications that can reduce the frequency of migraines. But I think a good first step would be, you know, setting up a visit with your eye doctor, explaining what's going on, and they would do a dilated exam where they would dilate the pupils and take a good look and see if there's any eye condition that might be causing it. And if the eye looks normal, then I would consider perhaps it might be a migraine.
Yeah. Something to think about, Lance. Thank you very much for calling. And let's go to Pat in Washburn, Wisconsin. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have recently been diagnosed with a macular hole. I have myopia, and I am scheduled for surgery in about 2 weeks and a vitrectomy. But my doctor didn't recommend a membrane peel, and I was wondering if something you could touch on. I had watched a YouTube video published by or broadcast by Mayo, and I tried to get into Mayo, but it's pretty well booked. So anyway, I'm trying to avoid the head down also aspect of the recovery. So if there's something that you can help me with to explain the membrane peel, and is that something that is successful?
Maybe start with a macular hole.
Yeah. So macular holes are a condition. We've been talking today about macular degeneration and macular edema. A macular hole is, as its name suggests, where a hole, typically a full-thickness hole, can develop in the macula. And that can, of course, as you would imagine, make vision blurry or distorted because of the hole. So these most often are related to aging changes in the eye. Sometimes they can be from an injury to the eye or other causes. And they are often treated with surgery, like a vitrectomy. I will give a disclaimer that I am not a retinal specialist. So the type of ophthalmologists who do surgery for macular holes have done 2 additional years of training specific to doing retinal surgery, such as fixing macular holes. I know there have been papers about doing it, you know, where people do have to have certain head positioning or don't, and whether membrane peeling is needed or not. And I think these are, I would have to say, a little beyond my immediate knowledge to be able to give you an educated opinion on it. I think that would be a better question for either your surgeon or even if you wanted to see a second retinal specialist as another opinion.
Yeah, that makes sense. Pat, thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, with your questions about your eye or your eye health. Our guest, Dr. Matthew Cook, ophthalmologist for Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at your eye's health today with Dr. Matthew Cook, ophthalmologist at Mayo Clinic Health Systems in Eau Claire. Great to have him with us. Colleen emailed us, Dr. Cook. Her daughter has a spot in her eye. Her optometrist says that's not uncommon, says it's a precancer, and they're keeping an eye on it, and she uses sunglasses. Colleen's never heard of it. Can they remove it, or are there other treatments?
I think this is a situation where I'd have to see the medical records to be able to speak confidently on what she's asking about, but I suspect she may be talking about a nevus of the eye. So a nevus is like a mole on the skin, but in this case, it's inside the eye. They can occur in different parts of the eye. The most common part is the choroid, which is in the back of the eye. So if it were in that part of the eye, we would call it a choroid nevus, or like a mole in the eye. And these can occasionally progress to cancer of the eye, but they usually do not. And there's not an easy way to treat them if they're, because they usually don't turn into cancer, we recommend watching them, generally speaking, because any treatment would make the eye worse. So we wouldn't want to do that for a benign condition. So without knowing all the details, I think the advice given was good. Keep an eye on it. Although things like surgery can be done if there was a thought that it might be cancerous, to do it, if the thought is that it's not cancerous, would be, I think, harmful and a bad idea.
Tom emailed us, is there any treatment for drusen eye? And could you explain it, what it is, and how to treat it?
Yeah, so drusen are, well, there are, drusen are basically calcific changes in the eye. And typically they occur in the retina. That's the back part of the eye where light is focused. They can also occur in the optic nerve, which is the nerve that connects the eyeball to the brain. So these are well, particularly drusen of the macula, which are the more common type or part of the retina, increase with age. And if people get enough of them, an eye doctor would diagnose that person as having macular degeneration, which is something probably most listeners have heard of. So it's a disease that can get worse over time. There's no cure for drusen of the macula. We watch them. If someone does develop macular degeneration, there are vitamins, over-the-counter vitamins called AREDS or AREDS 2, A-R-E-D-S 2, that can reduce the risk of macular degeneration getting worse. So an eye doctor might recommend those for a patient if they have enough drusen of the macula. But there's no treatment, unfortunately, that we have currently that makes them go away, and sometimes they can limit vision.
What if you know that you have some macular degeneration, your doctor hasn't recommended the AREDS 2, would it be okay to, since it's over the counter, to say, okay, I'm in the early stages of this, maybe I should take some of these AREDS 2?
Yeah, I get asked that question a lot by my patients, and what I tell them is, first of all, the vitamins are low risk, and so for most people, it's probably okay to take them. Having said that, they can cost $30 or more for a month, so they're not particularly cheap. Some people can get an upset stomach from them, so there are some downsides. And I think the other question is, would it be doing you any good to do that? What I would say is that the vitamins have been studied with people who have an intermediate or, you know, like a moderate level of macular degeneration. For those people, it helps. For people who do not have that, we don't know. It hasn't been studied. So I would say the benefit is less clear. I tell people that, and I think a lot of them use the vitamins anyway, and many of them don't. So I think it's unclear for other people whether it's helping them. So maybe you don't want to spend the money on them and take something, but other people prefer to, in the hopes it might be helping them.
Okay. Glaucoma, I understand one of your specialties is glaucoma. What happens to the eyes when you have glaucoma?
Yeah, so glaucoma is another fairly common disease. It's more common as people get older. And glaucoma affects the optic nerve, which, as I mentioned, is the nerve that connects the eyeball to the brain. So in glaucoma, although we don't completely understand everything that causes it, the eye pressure is too high. So in other words, the eye is too firm. And over time, in susceptible patients or individuals, that can cause damage to the optic nerve that's permanent. And in early stages of glaucoma, typically people wouldn't even know they had a problem with their eye. But as it gets more advanced, it can cause loss of vision, even sometimes blindness. So it can be a serious disease. And glaucoma, because it can be no symptoms and people might not know they have it, that's one reason we recommend periodic eye exams, even if people aren't having any trouble with their vision, particularly as they get older.
Is there something that leads to it? Is there, excessive drink or smoking or, any other bad mm-hmm. health kind of thing that we get involved with sometimes?
Yeah, so I would say glaucoma is not a disease that's strongly linked to, I'll say, lifestyle things like how you eat or what you drink, et cetera. There is some thought that cigarette smoking is probably a risk factor. But I would say the biggest risk factors for glaucoma are genetics. It tends to run in families. Older age is another major risk factor for it. And there can be other things like injury to the eye, certain medications like steroids, you know, certain eye conditions that can increase the risk of it as well, or certain medical conditions, I should say.
I think I've been tested for it when I visit the eye doctor, but maybe you could describe it, what happens under a test.
Yeah, so just at a basic screening eye exam, an eye doctor would be able to identify if you might be at risk for glaucoma. Typically, at an eye exam, the pressure is checked. So like the pressure in a tire, we need pressure in our eyes or they would collapse, but if the pressure is too high, it can cause glaucoma. And so checking the pressure is one way. And also the eye doctor can examine the optic nerve and does during an eye exam. And there are ways it looks that can tip doctors off to, hey, we need to do more testing and see if this individual might have glaucoma. For people who need extra testing, the testing can include things like doing a peripheral vision test, a side vision test, or being dilated and doing a scan of the optic nerve to see if there's damage there.
And treatments for it?
So the way I would say there are three general types of treatment. Medications, usually in the form of daily eye drops. Laser procedures. There are a couple different lasers that, depending on the type of glaucoma, may work as well or even better than eye drops. Or, in some cases, surgery, where there are different types of surgery, but the goal of all of these treatments would be to lower the pressure in the eye to a safe level so that the damage doesn't continue.
Elizabeth in Viroqua emailed us, Elizabeth's daughter is 11 years old, has nearsightedness, and wears glasses since the age of 8, so 3 years. Their optometrist is recommending atropine eye drops to help slow the progression of nearsightedness. This is a treatment she's not familiar with. What are your thoughts on it? The side effects, does it work?
Yeah, so typically what's done is a low dose of atropine is given. Atropine is an eye drop, or it's a medication that dilates the pupil, and it also reduces the ability of the eye to focus up close. So if someone took a full dose of atropine, their pupils would be dilated and they would not be able to read anymore. But typically what's done in this case is a low dose is given. With a low dose, the side effects are pretty low. You know, some patients can get blurry vision, or they may be sensitive to light from being a little dilated. But I would say there is evidence that it can work, that it can reduce or slow down nearsightedness getting worse. So I think it's a question, you know, to have with her doctor, but I think it's not an unreasonable suggestion.
And finally, are there vitamins just in general that someone can take for eye health? That's a question from Rick, I believe, in St. Germain.
Yeah, we talked about the vitamins earlier specific to people for macular degeneration. I think this is a question where if you ask 10 eye doctors, there might be some that would answer differently than I would. But my answer would be for people who do not have a vitamin deficiency, I don't recommend any particular vitamin. Instead, what I recommend is trying to eat a healthy diet because vitamins are in foods we eat too. And so trying to eat a lot of fruits and vegetables and whole grain, you know, products, things, lean meats when possible, more fish, less red meat. That type of a diet, I think, is healthy for the eyes. But any specific vitamins, I would say there's no proof or evidence that they would help the eye health, particularly in people without a vitamin deficiency.
Probably good advice for anybody. Good eye health or no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dr. Cook, it's been a pleasure. I hope you'll agree to come back and be with us again sometime. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah. Oh, I'd be happy to, and I really appreciate the invitation. Thanks so much.
Dr. Matthew Cook, ophthalmologist for Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire. Great to have him with us. And coming up, we're going to talk about the latest in diabetes developments. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're spending the next half hour or so talking about diabetes and the latest treatments available with our guest, Dr. Amrinder Singh. He is a family medicine doctor with Ascension, Wisconsin, in Mount Pleasant. So it's great to have Dr. Singh with us. We'll talk about GLP-1 drugs, continuous glucose monitors, and a whole lot more. And he's certainly ready to take your questions about living with diabetes as well. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. Dr. Singh, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here today.
How does diabetes occur in the body?
So diabetes, I like to describe it as a dysfunction of our metabolic system. That's a big generic way to look at it, but when we are taking in food, our bodies are just like automobiles, where we are utilizing that food as some sort of energy to continue our organs from working. In diabetes, what happens is there's a dysfunction of that metabolism, and that leads to the metabolic system unable to continue to use that glucose as the energy source in a appropriate way.
Yeah, and this, we often hear pre-diabetes is this sort of on the way. What's the difference between pre-diabetes and diabetes?
So I think the best way to look at that, pre-diabetes is like your check engine is on, your check engine light is on, and you know that, hey, I have to get it checked out and make sure that, hey, everything is okay. And it'll kind of give you an alert like, hey, maybe you're missing some fluid or maybe you're missing this. So pre-diabetes is that the system itself is starting to kind of become dysfunctional. And then diabetes is it has become fully dysfunctional, and we need some sort of assistance to try to help control how we metabolize our energy.
Is it in, let's say you go to the doctor for your checkup, your annual checkup, is a check for diabetes typically a part of that?
In most cases, we do a fasting glucose, which is part of a bigger metabolic panel that we actually order. In some instances, if you have certain risk factors, such as obesity, a family history of diabetes, or other metabolic concerns, for example, hypothyroidism, hyperthyroidism, we do check a hemoglobin A1C, which is a 3-month average of your blood sugars.
Let's talk about GLP-1 drugs. They've been in the news a lot as a weight loss drug, but they were originally developed for diabetes, I think. Anyway, what is that GLP-1 drug?
So what GLP stands for is glucagon-like peptide 1. So basically how it works is it binds to these receptors, the GLP-1 receptors, and it leads to more insulin secretion from our pancreas and suppresses something called glucagon. Glucagon 1 expressed brings in glucose, so basically the sugar, glucose, into the system, which then creates more damage to other parts of the body. So the idea of this medication is to basically have some effect on these two different hormones and then help regulate the blood sugars, your appetite, and curbing hunger.
I'm sure I've seen the ads. What are the major brand names of GLP-1?
Yeah, I'm sure everybody has seen all the ads these days. But so most commonly, most people have heard of Ozempic and Wegovy and Trulicity, which falls under the generic name of semaglutide, or Mounjaro or Zepbound, which falls under the generic of tirzepatide.
How effective are they?
So they're as effective as people make lifestyle changes. So it depends on each person, depends on how badly their diabetes has become. So it's more than just the medication. It's dependent on your lifestyle and even other pre-existing health conditions.
Kevin in Krivitz has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
And what's on your mind?
I was pretty suddenly diagnosed with diabetes. I went from a A1C of 5.9 up to 12.5 over the course of a few months after getting really sick with COVID, and it took a toll on me. And I found that swimming really helped control my blood sugar, and I got into a routine that really helped keep my numbers down, where I was actually reduced on medication. It worked out so well. I came up with such a good routine. I actually wrote a book on it called Swim Your Tail Off. I used a different word for tail, though. But and it really helped a lot of people, just a book. It helps. I wanted to help people do what I did, where I reduced my medication and kept my blood sugar down. I lost 30 pounds, and I did it all in a tiny 15-foot pool. Like, you don't need a giant swimming pool to get a good workout and to help with your blood sugar.
Oh, Kevin, thanks for calling. Comment, Dr. Singh.
I think that's amazing. I definitely think swimming is one of those underrated activities, not just for losing weight, but also it uses so many parts of your body that your energy, again, going back to the energy part, if you're utilizing your energy, the swimming is one of those things that utilizes your energy in such an effective manner. And it's also often when we talk about chronic low back pain or other musculoskeletal things, aquatic therapy is very often recommended also. So definitely, I think that's amazing to hear that it's not only helped him, but he's also gone ahead and, you know, produced a book out of it. That's awesome.
Yeah, it is awesome. And it's pretty low impact. You know, you're not pounding your ankles and your knees,
mm-hmm.
But you're getting a good workout. So, Kevin, good on you. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Bill in Madison has a different kind of question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Yeah, I am a type 1, and I'd appreciate it if you can focus on your talking specifically about type 2. And see, when people listen to this, they say, oh, if you take Ozempic, or, you know, you don't have to worry. Oh, are you still a diabetic? You should exercise more. I'm 170 pounds, 5'10", and all of that stuff, and it's crazy. You know, so it's extremely important to all of us to know the difference between type 1 and type 2. The other thing I was going to share is taking care of it. For me, it's a lot more detailed. First, I was the first person in Wisconsin to get an insulin pump, and that was 1980. Still use a pump, and it's great. I was also in studies for the glucose sensor. And the biggest thing about the glucose sensor for me is the alarms of not just the highs, but the lows, and how important it is. And for people to know that, boy, I tell you, it has just made a huge difference for me.
Bill, thank you very much for calling. Raises a number of things there, and maybe we just start with type 1 and type 2 and the differences.
Yeah, so, I mean, agreed. Thank you for bringing that up. I definitely think that type 1 diabetes isn't often discussed. It's considered more of an autoimmune condition, as the pancreas does not produce, in a simple way, does not produce insulin for the body, and therefore we need exogenous insulin. Or in other words, we need to take in insulin. So as he described, using something like an insulin pump has become a very often used treatment for our type 1 diabetics. And yes, these GLP-1s have not been used or studied as much in type 1 as it is it's been used in type 2. And therefore, that's why it's also with the weight loss. And so, yes, I think type 1, I think we as a medical society need to do even more to try to find opportunities to see if, you know, maybe our type 2s are type 1s or, you know, at a younger age, we typically see type 1s. But I think we've seen more and more type 1 diabetics being diagnosed at an older age.
Yeah. And those sensors that he was quite favorable about, the glucose sensors.
So I believe how he was describing it was within the insulin pumps, they have a system within itself. So the insulin pumps have a kind of monitor on its own. So typically it may be connected in most cases to some sort of device, usually these days a smartphone. So that alerts you when you are low. And I think that's extremely important. We always have a conversation with our patients. We don't want them to be too high and we don't want them to be low. But if I had to make if you gave me a choice, I'd say I'd rather you be high than too low, because too low means you do not have enough glucose, in other words, energy for something like your brain. And so that becomes very important, especially with type 1 diabetics. Mm.
Janet emailed us, can a preteen male child be more susceptible to diabetes if they are overweight?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we have seen that our more and more of a younger population has been diagnosed with diabetes or pre-diabetes because of being obese or being overweight and lifestyle. So, yes. But it is absolutely possible.
Dr. Amrinder Singh, our guest today, you can join in with your questions relating to diabetes at 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. Someone else is wondering about the side effects of taking the GLP-1 drugs.
That's a great question. So side effects typically range from low blood sugar, so hypoglycemia. You can have nausea, diarrhea, and then, you know, bloating, abdominal pain. And some of those may present because one of the things that the GLP-1s does is delay gastric emptying. So that basically means that instead, it keeps basically the food in your stomach without, you know, sending it out to your small intestines and kind of furthering the digestion. So sometimes that can lead to some of these symptoms that we're talking about.
So all in all, for someone with diabetes, is it a drug you recommend?
Yeah, I think definitely it is. I'd say that it has opened up a lot of doors for a lot of different people, but specifically in our diabetic population, it has made a significant difference. So I do definitely recommend this for our diabetic patients.
But at the same time, I hear in over the last 20 minutes or so there that patient behavior can have an impact on how effective these pills could be.
That's absolutely correct. I think that goes to any chronic conditions, but when we talk about a metabolic condition like diabetes, it makes even a bigger difference. So, you know, incorporating fruits and vegetables and just fiber in general is extremely important. In the fiber category, things like fruits, vegetables, whole grains like oatmeal, lentils, beans, all of those are great to help your blood sugars. Lean protein like chicken, turkey, fish, low-fat, high-protein dairy, like eggs and Greek yogurt, all of those, if those are incorporated into your diet, that will definitely keep your blood sugars at bay. And then, as we were talking about before, the exercise. Exercise is utilizing your energy, and if you can utilize your energy, that can help try to change the way that the metabolic system is working.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think about symptoms of diabetes, and, you know, maybe somebody is out there on the fence about getting tested for it. What are the basic symptoms?
So most commonly, you know, I'd say textbook of these type of symptoms is feeling extremely thirsty, which I'd say is probably more than usual. Like if it's a hot day and you're drinking more water, that's one thing. But, you know, if it's if you're not sweating and you're needing to keep, you know, feeling like you need to keep drinking, that's one. Urinary frequency. So if you're needing to urinate often, that's another. Feeling fatigue. That could be another sign of diabetes. Something called, eating too much, right? Just feeling like you need to continuously eat could be another sign of diabetes. So that's the most common textbook type of symptoms. Now, when sometimes your diabetes has been very uncontrolled and you just have not been diagnosed, you may get things like blurry vision, headaches, numbness and tingling in your extremities. Those may also be signs of diabetes.
How much exercise is good for or necessary for someone with, well, let's say pre-diabetes or diabetes? For example, do you need to do lots of cardio, or does going for a few walks a day help out? What's the advice there?
So I would say 30 minutes five times a week is probably 30 minutes a day, five times a week is probably the most, the best thing for everyone. I wouldn't even say it's specific for diabetics. As for cardio and strength, you can mix it up however you'd like. Does strength training have a lot of benefits over cardio? I'd say so, but I wouldn't want to put too much pressure that, oh, you need to do this much. But strength training, you know, the stronger your muscles are, the better use of energy that they use. So I definitely think strength training should be important, but cardio is also important. So trying to incorporate 30 minutes, 5 days a week, so about 150 minutes in a week is important. How you separate that out is completely up to you.
So you could go 20 minutes and 10 minutes and or the whole 30 at once, and, you know, that would do it.
Yes.
All right. That makes a lot of sense to me. I'm wondering, you know, sometimes people make assumptions about people who have diabetes. And I don't know that they're always correct. What, in your experience, what have been some of those assumptions?
I think the number one, when somebody gets diagnosed with diabetes, I think the number one concern is like, am I going to be on insulin for the rest of my life, or am I going to be on these medications for the rest of their life? And I think the way I answer that is it solely depends on you. If there was a lifestyle that brought this condition into place, now it's like, how do we fix that lifestyle so that in the future you don't have to be on medications and you yourself and the changes that you've made have changed that aspect. So I definitely think that those are some of the fears. And I think, you know, we just have fears. You know, you have a chronic condition and then you're like, oh my God, is this the beginning of the end for me? And I will tell people, no, it's not. It's the beginning of your new change. And I think that's the important key part to keep in mind.
Yeah, I think once somebody is diagnosed with it, it's a pretty big motivator, I would think, for changes. Do you find that in your practice?
Yeah, I've had great success stories where we've had patients who started off as one of the callers had said, an A1C of 12%, which is very high. And recently I was able to see him and we were able to come to a point of cutting. We were starting at 3 medications and now he's on 1 and we cut that medication in half. So, and he made huge strides right off the bat. So yeah, I think absolutely there are opportunities to improve.
Sounds like, do you see a lot of folks in your practice? You're with Ascension Wisconsin in Mount Pleasant.
Yes. Yes. And I will say that a good portion of my panel are patients with diabetes.
And if you are concerned about having diabetes, what do you tell your doctor? Just say...
Well, I think number one, it always starts off, and the best way is make sure that you're getting your annual physical. And if you are if you are having the symptoms that we discussed today, then I would make an appointment with your doctor and say, hey, I'm concerned that I'm having some of these symptoms and, you know, I may be overweight. I may be, just not feeling like myself. And I think those are usual trigger words for most primary care doctors to be able to do further testing.
Yeah. Well, on that note, Dr. Singh, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. I think we all learned more, and I hope we have a chance to do this again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry. I really appreciate the time today.
Dr. Amrinder Singh, our guest today, family medicine doctor, works with Ascension Wisconsin in Mount Pleasant. It's great to have him on to talk about diabetes, and we'll probably be getting him back at some point, and we'll do it all over again. We're going to switch directions now, as we often do on this program. We go from one topic to another, and coming up next, we're going to take a look at agroforestry. Is it something you've ever heard of? Maybe you're practicing it. We'd love to hear about that as well. That coming up next with our guest, Professor Michael Bell. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at agroforestry next on the program. It's been practiced around the world for centuries, including in the Midwest. And we'll be talking about it today and what it is and how it's being used in our neck of the woods. And we'll also hear about an event in Madison that's teaching about regenerative agriculture. Michael Bell with us. Great to have him with us in the studio. He's the Philip David Lowe and Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Community and Environmental Sociology at the UW-Madison. It's great to have him with us. And as we talk with Michael, I hope you'll join in with your own questions about growing crops right along trees and shrubs. Let us know what your interests are, and perhaps in a new way of growing crops. Or maybe tell us why you're passionate about regenerative agriculture. Love to hear from that perspective as well. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Michael, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's really a pleasure, and it's a pleasure to be here to talk about one of my favorite topics, which is trees and farming, how we can bring the two together.
What's the history of agroforestry? That's what it is, trees and crops together.
Exactly, and also shrubs as well. Well, you know, the history is as old as eating. We've been eating off trees. They give us so much, Larry. They give us food. They give us shade. They give us habitat. They give us air, too, because they're a very important part of giving us oxygen. And as well, they sequester carbon. Oh, we give them, they give us so much. But, you know, I mean, I think sometimes we take them for granted. And that really the agroforestry movement is about really celebrating what they have done for us for so long and what they can do for us in the future.
How popular would you say it is in Wisconsin, agroforestry?
Well, it depends whether you're talking about agroforestry. Oh, I know I'm doing agroforestry versus whether I'm actually doing agroforestry. I didn't even know I was doing it. So about a third of agricultural land in the United States is actually woodland. If you look at the land that is held by farmers for farming, about a third of it is woodland. And people commonly across Wisconsin are doing one of the most delicious forms of agroforestry, and that is maple syrup. Right, so it's very widespread. It's an old practice. Maple syrup, that was something, of course, that the native folks already, they taught everybody else how to do that, and they were so right. It's so good. And there's so many other really tasty, wonderful things that we can do with integrating trees and shrubs back more into our agriculture.
So this is fits into the concept of regenerative agriculture. I say about a week ago, I talked with Dick Cates Jr. Richard Cates has a new book out. It's called A Creek Runs Through This Driftless Land.
I own the book myself. Dick is an old friend. I was out at his farm just 6 weeks ago. So what a delight to be following after Dick.
So it's this whole business of regenerative agriculture. Talk about what it really involves.
Well, the Cates farm is such a good example of that. But we want to give an agriculture a chance to actually restore itself just as it is restoring us year by year by year. So an agriculture that doesn't run down the land, but actually lifts it up. Oh, that's what we really see at a place like Dick Cates' farm.
Yeah, it. What would you say qualifies as regenerative agriculture? And certainly his farm would be an example of it, but are there other examples that may be lesser examples of as compared to his?
Well, there's so many ways, but if I had to give a definition, I would say a regenerative farm is one that gives back as much as we take from it. So does it restore as it goes? Does it build the soil up? You know, soil health is so crucial, and I have this lab that we've started. We call it, you know, we like to call things labs in the College of Agriculture, even when we're social scientists. So we have our Soil Health and Agroecological Living Lab, which is a long name.
Yeah.
Our acronym is SHAL, Soil Health and Agroecological Living Lab. And I think that's really also part of the message of regenerative agriculture is the positiveness. You know, sometimes people say, oh, the farmers, they're poisoning us. They're eroding the land away. And farmers get irritated by this. And rightly so. And I think so many of what we need to communicate is how we can and we are restoring the land at the same time as we're taking and eating from it.
Yeah. So as we think about agroforestry, there are different systems and different kinds of ways that it is applied. Let's talk about some of those ways.
I'd be happy to, yeah. So generally in agroforestry, they like to think of five different forms.
Okay.
And I'm getting my PowerPoint slide out here in the mind for your audience. Okay, there, number one, there on the PowerPoint slide, right there at the top, is something which has been going on so long in Wisconsin agriculture, which is windbreaks.
Mm-hmm.
Windbreaks, of course, they break the wind. They also help cool the land, and as well, they hold on to the soil, and are so important and keeping more moisture as well. So by not drying things out. So not just preventing the crop from not being knocked over and the soil from blowing away, but in those other ways too. Another, number two on the slide, is silvopasture. So that is getting trees out onto the pasture and providing shade for the livestock so they're cool in the summer and so they're protected more in the winter. You can do that two different ways. You can either add trees onto a pasture, or you can subtract trees out of an existing woodland and introduce grass. They do both ways. Another is riparian buffers. So getting trees along our riverbanks and stream banks, helping slow water movement, you know, so we don't get those flash floods like that horrible thing that's just happened in Texas, that awful tragedy. Get the trees out there. That's really going to help with that. Another is alley cropping. So that's when you plant lines of trees or shrubs in between conventional crops. And that has all the effect of helping hold on to the soil and keeping the moisture and holding the wind down as well. And then the other is what they sometimes call forest farming. That's number five on the slide. And what they sometimes also call food forests. So that's when we actually eat straight out of the forest. And, of course, the classic example there is our maple syrup, but also there's forest botanicals and mushrooms and so many other delicious ways we can eat with trees.
Yeah, that's a lot to talk about. The alley cropping was kind of interesting to me. I'm trying to think about places in Wisconsin where it's being used, because this is very intentional. You're growing rows of trees, right?
That's right. Yep.
And then there's probably a little space for working around the trees or within the trees. But then down the middle of these rows, you plant. What do you plant?
Well, you could plant anything. You could plant corn. You could plant soybeans. You could plant alfalfa. You could plant really any field crop. And I think this is an important potential technique, because we're not talking about, oh, let's get rid of row crops or some silly thing like that, but how we can integrate the trees into row cropping and help make our row cropping more regenerative, holding onto the soil, holding onto the water, giving habitat, and also giving more things to eat.
Yeah, and where do we see that in the state? Do we have some examples of row cropping in the state?
You mean alley cropping?
I'm sorry, alley cropping?
Well, some, yeah. It's a newer technique. It takes a little bit more investment, right? And we also have to look to how we can make sure that with the lands of perennials that farmers are not losing income. So there's a lot of work going on to develop things like hazelnuts. We have delicious potential hazelnuts from the Midwest. They're smaller than the hazelnuts you often see in the market that we get out of Europe. But they're so, it's like you took all the taste of a hazelnut and you shrunk it into a smaller nut. All the flavor in half the size of the nut. They're so good. So there's hazelnut industry is really coming along now. But with all of these things, we have to also not just look at what's happening on the farm, but how it can be processed and marketed. And, you know, if you're just one farmer selling hazelnuts, yeah, okay, maybe you can do something, you know, with online and a CSA or something of that sort. But that's not really going to make the same kind of impact if we don't have the ways to process them and get them to folks pretty far removed from things.
Hmm. Dr. Michael Bell today. Professor Bell is the Philip David Lowe and Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor. That's a mouthful.
Yeah, I've just been doing this for a while, and they keep making my title longer.
He's with the Department of Community and Environmental Sociology at UW-Madison as we talk with him about agroforestry. And there's a celebration of agroforestry coming up. We're certainly going to talk about that as well. And looking forward to your own thoughts and comments about agroforestry. Are you involved in it in some way? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we talk agroforestry with our guest today, Michael Bell from the Department of Community and Environmental Sociology at UW-Madison. He's also very involved with the Soil Health and Agroecological Living Lab, or SHAL, at UW, and they're co-hosting an event we're going to be talking about, too, coming up in a minute. Questions for him or comments or maybe an experience to share, you can join in the number 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. We'd love to hear from you. And we're having some calls coming on, and we'll be with us in just a minute or two. Here's a question that I think any farmer is going to ask. How's this going to affect finances and farm finances?
Hopefully not at all. It might actually increase the finances as we develop our specialty crops. Things like, of course, maple syrup, but newer things like the hazelnuts that we're trying to develop. Also, an exciting development now is trying to bring chestnuts back to the upper Midwest using a hybrid between Chinese chestnuts and the American chestnut. Oh, chestnuts, they're so good. They're so good. And then other things like the forest botanicals, like calendula and also ginseng, golden seal, mushrooms. These are all things that can be grown in your woods, and people can be eating them, and you can be making a tidy profit from.
Tanya in Stevens Point has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, Tanya.
Hi. I am so glad that you guys are talking about this. I walk through my woods every day, and I just recently found hazelnut trees in there, and the mushrooms and all the medicinal plants and things, and I think, why isn't anybody harvesting this stuff, you know? And I thought about putting something together like a forage spot, you know, kind of like forest finders, you know, where people can just come and forage in there and enjoy it. But yes, getting crops underneath the solar panels, why can't we grow ginseng underneath there? And I live across the street actually from Heartland Farms Field. It is ridiculous. It's so frustrating to deal with the pesticides and the dust and I just get devastated by the dust storms coming off their fields. And my main question is, are you talking to those farmers and encouraging them to do different practices? I talked to them one day about beneficial nematodes. They've never even heard of it.
Well, so that communication, thanks so much for the question. That communication piece is so crucial. And that's part of the reason why we're having this festival here in Madison, but we hope to repeat it elsewhere in the state in the future, what we're calling Savannah Jam. So a celebration of agroforestry. And putting music together with that and making the learning fun, I think part of the reason so often that folks don't know about some of the practices that they could be having is because we get disconnected from each other. And knowledge is so much not just about facts, but about building connections. And so a festival, a place where people could come together, have fun with each other, hear beautiful music, have food together, and then suddenly you're building new networks, finding new friends, and say, oh, right, oh, you're growing mushrooms in your woods? Huh, maybe I'll try that too. Oh, wow, you can put up a windbreak. Hey, and then my dust won't blow off into my neighbors and it'll stay on my field. And at the same time, I'm going to harvest chestnuts from it. So all these possibilities there. It's so great to hear your appreciation of possibilities.
Tanya, thank you so much for calling. Let's talk about, is this the sort of mission, or maybe I should say, what is the mission of SHAL, the Soil Health and Agroecological Living Lab? Talk about its construction and what it's about.
Yeah, I think it is about us thinking about agriculture as about living. So it's not just about producing things, but it's also about all the relationships that are involved between farm and plate and all the people along the way, whether it's the farm owner, whether it is the farm workers, whether it's the folks who are doing the processing, the transporting, the chefs, the eating that goes on. And so we celebrate our connection with the environment in the most intimate of ways, I think. You know, I think one of the things that's important to remember is that our stomach is very close to our heart. So if you really want to get that connection of the environment to people, do it through their stomach. And I think we're really trying to do that with SHAL and this event that's coming up. And we're not the only ones. So, for example, the Savannah Institute is this fantastic new organization centered in Wisconsin. It's also in all of the Midwest now. It came from the work, mainly from the work of a former PhD student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Keith Keeley. They were a little tiny organization. They had like one employee, I think. And then they got Keith in there as their executive director after he finished his PhD with Steve Ventura as his chair. Mm-hmm. Maybe you know Steve. And
we talked about that on the show once.
Oh, you did? Okay. Well, Savannah Institute now has 50 employees, and they have spun off a for-profit company called Canopy Farm Management, which is showing folks how you can really make a living at this. And people are making enough of a living at these techniques that they're willing to pay Canopy Farm Management to show them how to do it. So this is really practical stuff. It's not, well, I suppose it's a pie a little bit in the sky because trees are high, right? And in a certain sense, right, maybe you can make a chestnut pie or something of that sort. But it's really grounded at the same time, just like the roots of a tree are grounded. This stuff is possible. People are doing it. They're making money at it. And they are making our world a better place at the same time.
Mary Kay in Kenosha has a comment for us, I think. Mary Kay, hello.
Hi, I'd like to see some crabapple trees, some plum trees, some Brazil nuts if we could possibly have them, miniature peaches.
You've got a number of ideas. You have a number of crop ideas there, Mary Kay.
Absolutely, Mary Kay. And orchards, of course, is a very old tree-based practice, and people can bring these into their yards. I have a sour cherry tree in my yard. I have plum trees in my yard. I have hazelnuts in my yard. I have currants. That's another agroforestry crop that we've neglected. Currants are so tasty. Oh, they're so good. Right. So, yeah, there are all these possibilities. And we can do them in our home yards, too. But, of course, it's really going to make the biggest impact if we're doing them on farms.
Let's talk about your celebration of agroforestry. It's at Westmoreland Park in Madison. It's on Thursday evening.
Yes, it's coming up this Thursday from 5 to 8 p.m. We love Westmoreland Park because it actually has a small oak savanna in it. It's a very sweet place to be in general. And we will have music. There'll be food. So we're going to get the fun in there and place for connection. Actually, my band is going to be one of the groups performing. It's called Zusammen, which means together in Yiddish, also in German. And then also Allison and Taylor Ackley, who are a nationally known folk duo, will be performing. Allison's actually from Madison originally, so that's part of the reason why we were able to get them to come and for this event. Zusammen will be 5:30 to 6:30, and then Allison and Taylor are 7 to 8. And in between, there's going to be a time to go and mingle with the booths that some 14 different sustainable agriculture and regenerative agriculture organizations will have there. Great opportunity to come and learn about these sustainable practices groups. Like, for example...
Yeah, give us some examples.
Yeah. The REAP Food Group. That's Research, Education, Action, and Policy on Food Group. The Worm Farm Institute, which is a rural arts organization. They're going to have two of these wonderful culture stands that they have. These old kind of farm wagon-y things that they've made into these beautiful artworks. They're just glorious. There'll be Grassland 2.0, which is actually a UW project about perennializing our landscape. They'll have a booth there. MITEI, the Mission to Improve Global Health Through Innovation, is also an organization started up by Valerie Stahl, who is a faculty associate and at Shell, actually, at the university. And that's an organization that she started up that really focuses on women's empowerment through agriculture, particularly in Africa. So she'll be there talking about her work. The Dane County Tree Board will be there. The Edible Landscapes Committee of the Madison Food Policy Council will be there. The Driftless Area Land Conservancy will be there. Savannah Institute will be there. And one more organization I want to mention, which is Savannah Sanctuary. This is a new organization here in Wisconsin. They have a beautiful farm very close to Governor Dodge State Park where you can go and rest and relax. And that's one of the beauties of trees is that shade and that beauty. And so they're also trying to integrate the arts and music into regenerating our land through agroforestry.
So that sounds like a lot of fun. So you hear some music, and then you have an opportunity to mingle with the folks that are in charge of their various organizations, and then hear some more music.
Exactly. And there's activities for kids. There'll be face painting. There'll be tree talks. There'll be a scavenger hunt for kids. So, yeah, bring the family, bring the friends, and it's supposed to be a beautiful evening.
And the price is right.
It is free. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. At courtesy of Shell and the University of Wisconsin, and as well, some of our partner organizations are also contributing.
If you type in Savannah Jam in your computer, it's probably going to come up if people want to learn some more about it. But it is Thursday evening, this coming Thursday, from 5 to 8. There is a rain date in case, but that's
Tuesday. It's supposed to be beautiful. We're good. We don't need to worry about the rain date. We're going to be good. Yeah, it's supposed to be just a fantastic Wisconsin evening. I think we're maybe going to get a little of Taylor and Allison's music here.
To end it off.
Yeah.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Professor of Community and Environmental Sociology at UW-Madison. And in the background, you're hearing some of the music you might be hearing. Yeah, there it is. That's going to be a lot of fun, and it's Thursday night from 5 to 8. Thank you so much for listening today, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Blair.